Welcome to Rolling Start. I am Justin Anukasi, and I am your host for this fascinating series. I speak to successful business leaders from all walks of life who tell me about their professional and personal journeys so far, including some of the tough barriers they've had to break through in order to get there. In this episode, I speak to Andy Smith, Executive Director of NCM Auction, public speaker, consultant, co-founder of a chain of local farm and deli shops, Smithton's, and of course, finalist on the famous Channel 4 social media reality TV show, The Circle. Andy, absolute pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for joining us on Rolling Start.
So let's jump right into it then. Can you run through your upbringing, childhood, schooling, up to the age of around about 16 and what that was like for you?
I'd say normal, but I think everyone's childhood's normal, isn't it? You only know what you know, I suppose. I look back now as a parent and see that it was probably not normal, but I felt very loved, very supported, very like I could be who I wanted to be. There was no external pressure academically or anything. It was only my sister had some pretty serious mental health issues as she hit her early teenage years. And I suppose, as I say, it was already slightly dysfunctional looking back. Don't think that's anything to do with the mental health condition that my sister then suffered with. I think she was kind of born that way. So that led to kind of a challenging 3 or 4 years where, not that I was on my own, because I was kind of happy doing my thing. Mum and dad were there if I needed them. School was a bit of a non-event. I was very popular, very talented at sports. I had the sports tie, captain of most of the sports teams. So I think you kind of get a free pass, which I don't know whether that is right or wrong, but if you're relatively gifted at sport, teenager, life is a lot easier for you. I felt like life wasn't really challenging me, other than like emotionally with what was going on with my sister. Then I hit 15, was food poisoned. I just never really got better. It was only once I got to college or sixth form that it became clear that I was pretty desperately unwell and was having blood transfusions, and it just snowballed really quickly. So as I say, if you're asking what was my early years like, it was a doddle until it wasn't a doddle.
15 years old, you got food poisoning. What happened there?
Just me and the family, we went for curry, and me and my dad had the same meal, both got food poisoned, and he got better, and I just never got better. And if anything, I got worse and worse, and for about a year and a half, the doctors and people were telling me that I was putting it on. I don't know what the right term is, because and it was only when, to kind of give the crudeness, I went to the toilet on like Christmas Eve when I was 16 and probably lost, it's hard to contextualise it, but probably like a litre of blood, and shouted my mum. Because we've been going back and forth to the doctors. And as I say, if I give you the context, where my dad's like, you just need to crack on. Part of it was, I didn't like exams. Was he anxious? Was he, like, all these words that didn't mean anything to me at the time.
Yeah.
And people are telling you you're okay. So then you start to go, well, perhaps it's me then. But perhaps I'm nervous. And I suppose almost the blood coming, I mean, it was terrifying, but there was a level of relief of almost the acknowledgement that that's not normal. So now someone can help me.
Yeah.
And had all the old rectal examinations that come with it. And yes, I was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, but there's a real spectrum of that. So there's Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And colitis is restricted to your large bowel, whereas Crohn's can be kind of any part of your digestive system until you've got it. It just became clear that my life was going to be very, very, very different. But because this was when all the stuff was happening with my sister, my mum and dad got some of the other members of the family to go to the hospital with me. And so mum and dad were totally aware, helping me, but they weren't on the journey with me, if that makes sense, to a degree. And then I went to uni at 18, and I'd had a couple of blood transfusions by this point. 2 weeks in, and I'd been moved to a hospital in Sheffield because it needed ongoing treatment, and it was just a non-starter. It was it became clear I was going to lose my bowel, so I stuck it out in Sheffield for a year because I'd paid for my student digs and just got a job at Sheffield United and tried to manage on some very heavy medication, try and enjoy that year, knowing that, without being too morbid about it, the rest of my life might look quite different, but no one knew quite what. So, yeah, I think from 16 to 18, it was really difficult because obviously it was college. That's kind of when you start to form who you are. And I think it's also, though, where motivation, stuff that you couldn't teach what I had in me to a degree where I didn't feel frightened. People kept telling me what I wasn't going to be able to do. I don't know how else to describe. And I was like, well, who are you to tell me? And almost my own naivety was my kind of shield. And so as I was getting iller, I was still working hard at college, but it actually taught me if you put the work in at the front end, because I was getting so ill, I'd never leave anything to the end deadline because I couldn't legislate. I might be in hospital, therefore miss the deadline and fail. So I did everything at the front end, but it meant it bought me time to do a great job at the work. So I think by the end of it, I was 7 marks off the perfect score over 2 years in those two A-levels. I started to think, what does life look like after this? Because knowing the surgery was coming, because I think I had 2 lots of surgery, both 13 hours. I was in for 4 months the first time. I nearly passed away through some complications with post-surgery. So that took... I was only supposed to be there, I think, for about 6 to 8 weeks, and I was there for like 16. Went home with a colostomy bag and got to the point again, because I was always being told life's going to be different, you can't eat these foods, you won't. And I got to the point where I was playing football again with this colostomy bag, knowing that I've got another lot of surgery coming 3 or 4 months later, which was again another 13 hours.
Yeah.
I'm back in hospital for 12 or 16 weeks again. And so it was 2 lots of rehabilitation over a year.
Just thinking about, as you were going through that, I just wanted to talk about how, what you had through that. You mentioned family, friends, but yeah, I'm curious to kind of the support you had, but also then how you think you got through it.
Yeah, I think it changed my relationship with my dad when my dad and I, we were close, but it was functional. There was love, but it was disciplined. He was there every night. Like he was, I suppose, my crutch, and my mum, I suppose, almost took my sister, and my dad took me, because we were, let's be realistic, riddled with issues between the two of us. When I came out of hospital, my dad was the big crutch in hospital. He just sat there every night. And it was, I'd say, seminal for our relationship, in my view, because it bonded us over stuff that wasn't practical, I suppose. And then when I got out, dad, mum, I think it took me like, once I got home, maybe 6 weeks to walk about 200 yards and then back to the house. So I was so reliant on other people that I felt really, really supported at that point.
Yeah.
And then it was just, for me, I was always trying to do more, because I want to go play football, I want to do it. And then managing me, I suppose, because I probably would have set myself back at the pace I wanted to go at. So I think very much once I came out of hospital, I felt real support, because the first time I had a shower alone, and when you have a colostomy bag, your intestines are stapled to the outside of your stomach, and seeing it wiggle and stuff like that I just wasn't ready for. Because although it was in hospital, it felt different. So I blacked out. So I was like, shit, I'm not ready for this. So no, I think at that point, everyone really rallied around me. I felt a lot of love and a lot of support.
So then let's move on to the career and the next step. So you're at Sheffield United Football Club. How do you then progress on to the next roles that you had? And then in particular, how did you balance it with everything you're going through?
It became clear in my mind I wanted to work for the football club permanently. And I was offered the job of the assistant bar and retail manager within probably 6 months of me going back to Sheffield. And I don't want this to sound arrogant, I was just really good at it, like really good at it. Like I had no comprehension of what I was doing, but I was brave. Because of what I'd been through, I had a really bizarre relationship with risk, and I'd just go with what felt right, and it kept working. And not only did it work, it would work over and over again. So by the time my manager was essentially sacked, I took over 6 months later and probably put about nearly £300,000, I think, on the bottom line at Sheffield United Football Club.
Wow.
And then an insane year took place where suddenly I was the general manager of Sheffield United Football Club. I got like 3 promotions in a year. But again, this is like luck. And I remember having this conversation with my dad again. You can tell like a big part of my life. And me saying to him, I think I can be the general manager. And my dad going, you're fucking not going to be. Get real. Like, just get one job, because my dad had the same job almost his whole life, bar a couple of changes at the beginning of his career. Just settle down, will you? Because by this point, I've dabbled in other businesses as well. Like, I have an entrepreneurial dream. And he's watching me trying to buy little delis and burger vans and thinking, what is this kid doing? And I got the job, much to his dismay. And then we were sold. And when I say to we, not the whole football club, the operational part of the football club, catering, events, cleaning, secure, like the stuff that is not the footballers, to Compass Group. I'm suddenly the youngest general manager in Europe in a FTSE top 25 business. But I was smart enough to realise that big companies take the head off the beast and put one of their own in. So I asked to become the deputy to learn from someone who had been in their system.
Mm.
They put two people in within the first 12 months, total dog shit. And the staff that used to work for me basically led a revolt with the kind of football club and said, I was known as Brummy to all the people at Sheffield United Football Club. Mm-hmm. Unless Brum is reinstated as the GM, we're done. Suddenly I'm the GM again, but I'm not only the GM of Sheffield United Football Club, I'm in a FTSE business and I have to learn things that I've never learned. They recognise, and it's something that stayed with me for the rest of my career, a bit like there was two Simons and a Jason at Sheffield United Football Club who gave me the job. And they never said this to me, but what I took from it always was recruitability over everything else. Recruitability over experience, recruitability over skill, because everything else can be taught. You cannot teach ability. And without sounding arrogant, ability I had in spades, but I needed controlling to a degree. I was a maverick and they were so good to me and so was Compass. And they put me on this fast track system where like the 20 best managers had like 40 odd grand spent on them. Mm. And they kind of educated me properly in kind of how you build a profit and loss, how you influence numbers and people. Yeah. And whilst that course didn't teach me tons, it reaffirmed that the gut instincts I talked about where it kept going right, they were telling me about the behaviours of successful people. And I was going, this is how I think. So then what it did do was give me confidence to go with my gut instinct and be willing to kind of live by the sword, die by the sword. So Sheffield United went well for a couple of years, took it from a loss-making business for Compass Group to decent profits. I was then given Edgbaston, Warwickshire County Cricket Club, which was near my house. So I did for a year between the two. And then after that, I moved to Leicester, which was a total, total train wreck, losing £1 million a year. I had to remove the entire senior management team, bar two people, in trouble with the government as well at the time for some stuff that had taken place, nothing to do with the football, just things that we should have done in terms of food hygiene that hadn't took place. Yeah. And one of the hardest jobs I've ever had, the resilience that I'd learned. I was up and running then. I was winning the CEO's outstanding contribution award within the whole of kind of the Compass Group infrastructure, turned Leicester around. But after a year, I was like, this isn't for me. And took over the Ricoh Arena, which I think was probably the bit that has given me the career that we're talking about. But that was a big challenge because they'd lost Coventry City Football Club. Yes. So what do you do with a football ground and no football club? And suddenly I've got a team of nearly 200 full-time staff and 800 part-time staff. And I think at the time, 7 million turnover with about £700,000 net profit contribution. By the time I left 2.5 years later, it was £20 million business with a £3.7 million contribution. But it was an exhibition centre, it was hotels, it was conferences, it was events, it was Bruce Springsteen concerts, Rihanna concerts. Yeah. It showed me what I wanted from the business world, but it also showed me that I didn't want to work for a big business. Mm-hmm. And I was at that point headhunted to join Game Digital as a director. So I joined Game on the basis that we'd hosted one of the largest gaming festivals in Europe at the Ricoh Arena, which is how I knew them. And the two brothers that had sold the business to Game were being asked to a degree to step aside. So they wanted almost a palatable person that they knew to have their baby to. And Game needed a credible director that again, it was quite quickly fast-tracked. For the first 6 months, I was kind of working with the brothers. Mm. And then I ended up, not as a board member, but at all the board meetings and one of the kind of senior team at GAIN, reporting into the CEO of the group, which was at the time probably £800-900 million business. So I was exposed again at the highest level I'd been to, again, it was a public business, what it looks like, nomads, announcements. But I suppose the Rico was a lead up to it. But whilst I had a boss, it was the CEO of the group at 27, 28, I am at this point. Just total autonomy within my own area, really. But sadly, I joined GAIN just before they had, I think on my like 7th week, they did their first profit warning, and there was 2 more to follow in the next year. Crazy now, I've lived in that world, but I had no idea what profit warnings truly meant. Not only as a profit warning, but the ramifications within a business. So the kind of brief I'd been given was changed 7 weeks in. So when it had been acquired, money was chucked at it. It was going to be the biggest thing ever. And I was headhunted to lead the charge. And suddenly I found myself leading the regrouping and 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 restructures over the next 3 years and shrinking this beast whilst trying to grow it. And I loved the people. I loved the business, but I didn't love the restrictions. And it just always became clear to me that I think I always demonstrated by a lot of people that have worked with me, have come with me to the next job. So I think I'm a really good leader. But the problem is that's based on a very strong moral compass. And if things aren't being, and when I say not done the way I believe they should be, I don't mean as in I need to get my own way. I just think when you're making decisions that you know to be wrong, because that's what you have to do, that for me is the beginning of the end. And at that point, I was then headhunted by a company that was listing on the AIM stock market to become their CEO. And again, it felt like another step up the ladder, public again, but I was like the third member of staff. So you're like, well, I can shake this. I'm only working for the executive chairman. I'm on the board. So although you have a boss, but you don't in that scenario, really, you're one of the board members. And at that level, there's almost a moral agreement that we work for the board, we work for the shareholders. Like, I loved the business and I loved the people, but we just weren't doing it the way I believed it should be done. And I kept wrangling with it, and we purchased a company, which was the largest Lego model building business in the world. Did some amazing, I mean, honestly, some of the stuff I'm most proud of in my career. I became the chairman of that as well. But again, it's not about me being right, but what I believed we should be doing and how we should do it. I secured the rights to Paw Patrol, Peppa Pig, SpongeBob SquarePants, Paddington, like to me, the biggest kids brands in the world, alongside a great kid brand as well. But suddenly the share price is starting to tank. And me and being candid, gotten brilliantly with the executive chairman, but we just couldn't have been 2 more different people. And at the beginning, that was a huge strength. And then it became a huge weakness. And it was all of my own choosing to leave. They were very clear they wanted me to stay. But I just felt there were certain things I wanted to do. And my health was playing up again at this point. If you notice in my career, I've started off as almost the biggest businesses you can be. And it's got quite, like a Russian doll, got infinitely smaller. But I suppose I've realised I am who I am. And I think anyone that's met would tell you I'm not a difficult guy, but I like to see the right things done, do good things by people, and they're not always the most palatable things. So that led me to opening my consultancy business and then the shops and a person who, to go full circle, was my sales director at Sheffield United Football Club, had founded her business, which was the auction business, and then asked me to come on board as kind of her partner, which has led me to be the exec director of NCM 13 years after we originally met.
You mentioned about your health again in that role.
Yeah.
What happened there?
It all got a bit messy, so I suppose I've kind of skipped. At the point when I was at the Rico Arena, part of me wanting to go to GAIN, I lost my mom in pretty tragic. So she had cancer, but she suffocated to death. Oh. And I had to hold her hand while it was happening. It triggered PTSD, but I suppose I struggled to come to terms with it because I was having what at the time was, we thought, panic attacks.
Yeah.
And after a couple of years of counselling, it became clear, once I suppose almost I was ready to truly talk about how I felt. I had PTSD, and it was absolutely what happened to my mum that triggered it. But I was reliving how I nearly passed away when I was 18, when I lost my bowel, when there was complications. I was wrestling with that. So I was, mum died 4 hours before her funeral. My daughter was born. 10 days after my daughter was born, my small bowel collapsed and I was in hospital for 4 months. So I never got to see my daughter, and it masked some of the issues as well. So when I came out, it had almost skipped the grieving, and the PTSD was there and some of the attacks were happening, but it was easy to write it off as this, well, it's a mess, isn't it? The death, the birth, the funeral, the surgery. Basically, I went back to work probably after about 6 months. I spoke to my boss and I just said, look, I can't do this. I can't keep pretending I'm okay. I'm not. You have to do what makes you happy. But I'd given it long enough to know that wasn't going to make me happy. And physical health, mental health, and just a desire to do me, in inverted commas, and live the life that I wanted with the control that I wanted.
Thank you, Andy. You've got many admirers and you'll probably have more after listening to this podcast. You do public speaking. How do people get in touch with you for speaking opportunities?
LinkedIn. I mean, there's a million Andy Smiths, but Instagram, where it's Andy_Smith_2Beans. But Andy Smith 2Beans, somewhere on the internet, will find you in the direction of me. But it's something I've become really passionate about, kind of sharing my story, because I've learned over the years that actually when you share, it does uplift and does help. And I'm quite candid, because it's easy for me to read out my career and for everyone to think that he's got his shit together and his life must be dreamy. But it's not. That's the reality. Like, we've all got our own struggles and it's never all plain sailing. So yeah, something I'm really passionate about is and I do a lot of stuff in schools and things like that, because I, as I said, at the really very beginning, very average student, unmotivated by the education system. I just don't think the education system's built for what the big wide world actually looks like. It's a tick box exercise at times.
Thank you so much for joining us, Andy, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. If you've been inspired by Andy's story, please go to rollingstart.org.uk for more information. On the next episode, we'll be speaking to Yasmina Siadarten, former winner of hit TV show The Apprentice and now sales and marketing director at Dynamic Planner. See you next time.